Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sam Pizzicati, veteran labor journalist and author, who assesses President Obama's second-term agenda addressing rising economic inequality in the U.S., a report on the largest climate change protest in U.S. history, organized to oppose construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, with speeches by environmental activist Van Jones and Texas rancher Eleanor Fairchild. And peace and social justice organizers Leslie Kagan and Bill Fletcher Jr., who reflect on the 10th anniversary of the February 15, 2003 Global Day of Protest that attempted to stop President Bush's disastrous war on Iraq. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over a decade after the 9/11 attacks and multiple conflicts around the world involving Islamic extremists, peace may be at hand on the Philippines island of Mindanao, where 40 years of civil war by Muslim rebels led to 120,000 deaths in a brutal conflict over land, resources, and religion. Through extended peace talks inspired by the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or the MILF, has broken away from terrorist networks and negotiated a plan with the Philippines government to create a self-governed Muslim body called Bangsa Moro, or Land of the Moro. According to the Guardian newspaper, a binding treaty could be finalized within weeks as Philippines President Benigno Aquino recently visited Mindanao and met with MILF leaders. If approved, the new autonomous state of Bangsa Moro could become a reality in 2016 as Aquino leaves office. Outstanding issues remain around territory, wealth sharing, and demobilization of the 12,000-soldier MILF army. Civil society leaders also have concerns about the status of women and the rights of the indigenous non-Muslim population under Sharia law in the new Muslim autonomous zone. Pressure for a deal has been building for some time due to the untapped oil and gas reserves near Mindanao, calculated by the U.S. State Department to be worth over $1 trillion. Melting Arctic ice and expanding sea lanes have put international focus on the low-key Arctic Council, comprised of eight nations, including the United States, Canada, Denmark, and Russia, who have territory in the Arctic Ocean. More countries are now seeking to join the Council as shipping traffic increases, a consequence of climate change. According to The Economist, Asian trading giant Singapore has applied for permanent observer status on the Arctic Council in order to defend its trading interests and to take steps to halt the melting of the ice cap, which could put the city-state underwater. China, India, South Korea, the European Union, Greenpeace, and the International Association of Oil and Gas Producers are also trying to win seats on the Council. Energy companies are especially interested in having a voice on the Arctic Council because the body sets rules for trade and development of the Arctic Ocean region. The United States Geological Survey estimates the Arctic has 13% of the world's untapped oil reserves and 30% of all potential gas reserves on the planet. The Canadian government has expressed concern about the growing pressure to exploit resources in the Arctic, which scientists say could cause permanent damage to the region's pristine ecosystem. 2 years ago, agents from the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or ATF, inspected the records at Taylor's Trading Post, a gun shop in rural Pennsylvania. It was the first inspection at the gun shop in 30 years. There, agents uncovered thousands of violations of federal gun laws. The shop owner could not account for over 3,000 guns that were bought and sold over the previous 3 years. The ATF sought to revoke Scott Taylor's license to sell guns in November 2011, but Taylor, running the shop from his house, continued to sell guns for 14 months as he pressed an appeal in federal court. The slow enforcement action against Taylor's Trading Post illustrates how difficult it can be to enforce current gun laws under the constraints of the ATF's limited budget and number of agents. According to the Center for Public Integrity, 8 years can go by before a gun dealer undergoes an inspection. In the wake of the Newtown, Connecticut Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, the ATF is coming under increasing scrutiny. Becca Knox of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence complains current rules handcuff federal agents by barring them from conducting more than one spot inspection a year of gun dealers. On the other hand, opponents of the reform of gun laws, like the NRA, say the ATF inspections are arbitrary and unfair. However, current federal law requires all gun dealers to record all transactions so any gun used in a crime can be traced. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Obama's State of the Union address, delivered before Congress and the nation on February 12th, laid out priorities for his second-term agenda. Prominent among Mr. Obama's proposals was his call to raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $9 an hour while indexing future increases to inflation. The minimum wage had not been raised since 2009. While conservative opponents assert any increase in the minimum wage will force small businesses to reduce hiring, there are many studies that contradict this view. Other proposals made by the president addressing the economy and the nation's shrinking middle class include providing universal access to pre-kindergarten education for low and moderate income families, restoration of the payroll tax cut, and linking federal student aid to reining in runaway college tuition costs. The context for many of the White House economic policy proposals is the continuing rise of economic inequality in the U.S. seen in recent data. University of California economist Emmanuel Saiz finds that America's top 10% collected 46.5% of all income in 2011, excluding investment gains, its highest share since 1917. Households in the nation's top 1% during the years of economic recovery from the Great Recession have gained 11.2% in income, but the incomes for the bottom 99% have actually shrunk. Your reporter spoke with Sam Pizzigatti, veteran labor journalist, Institute for Policy Studies associate fellow, and editor of Too Much, a weekly newsletter on excess and inequality. Here he assesses how effectively President Obama is addressing rising economic disparity, as well as lessons we can learn from past social justice movements covered in his new book, The Rich Don't Always Win.
Scott, I think he laid out probably his most clearly yet, his description of inequality, his picture of inequality. He painted a pretty clear picture. He talked about, for instance, millions of Americans whose hard work and dedication have not yet been rewarded. He talked about corporate profits having rocketed to all-time highs, but for more than a decade, wages and incomes have barely budged. He even went on to say it is our unfinished task to make sure that this government works on behalf of the many and not just the few. And then he went on to talk about some proposals to help the many: higher minimum wage, universal preschool education, pay equity for women. But I'm afraid that the president misses the prime lesson from the past, the prime lesson from past struggles against inequality. And that is that if you want to create a decent society, you can't just work at lifting people at the bottom up. You have to look at the top as well. And you have to not just look, you have to confront the wealth and power concentrated up there. And when you listen to this, when you listen to the State of the Union and you read the other things from this administration, they're still unwilling to confront that wealth and power concentrated at the top.
Sam, lay out for us what are the measures you think would be wise at this point in terms of addressing economic inequality, apart from policy measures near the bottom, but addressing the source of the inequality with the enormous and what many consider obscene levels of compensation major corporate executives give themselves and the wealth that flows to those people who don't even work for a living.
Well, what I try to do in my book, The Rich Don't Always Win, is look back to what our progressive forebears did to confront inequality. And it's very interesting when we do that, because if we look back 100 years ago, progressives, our forebears, the progressive forebears, faced a situation very, very similar to what we had today. They had a colossally wealthy, super rich, essentially dominating the political and economic order of this country at the beginning of the 1900s. Yet by the 1950s, that plutocracy had essentially disappeared. And America had emerged after World War II as the first mass middle-class country in the history of the world, the first country in history where a majority of the people were not poor. That was a tremendous, tremendous achievement, and I think we need to look back at how did they do that. They did that in two ways. One, putting in effect a steeply progressive tax system. In this country. And the second big thing they did, the second institution they created, was a strong, vital labor movement. And both those systems, the steeply graduated progressive tax system and the labor movement, essentially shrank that super rich down to democratic size. And I think we need to rebuild those two institutions today.
What is the easiest thing, you think, to achieve in the short run? Because economic inequality continues to run rampant, and so many people are being left out of the American dream. And certainly we saw with the Occupy Wall Street movement that there is a lot of anger out there and willingness to get out in the streets and do something.
Well, I think one very specific strategic job that we could set out to accomplish would be to leverage the power of the public purse against inequality. And what do I mean by that? Right now, every major corporation in the United States depends in one way or another on our tax dollars. Major corporations either get government contracts, government procurement projects. General Electric, Lockheed Martin, all the major corporations have billions and billions of dollars in federal contracts. They also have billions and billions of dollars of other sorts of development subsidies and tax breaks. We need to say, if you want tax dollars for government contracts, for subsidies, you can't pay your top executives more than 25 times what you pay your lowest paid workers. We're going to deny federal contracts to you, to your corporation, if you enhance inequality in the United States with your corporate pay system. Denying federal contracts and federal subsidies to corporations that contribute to inequality in their internal pay practices could start us down the road to a more equal United States.
That was Sam Pizzagatti, Institute for Policy Studies Associate Fellow and author of the book, The Rich Don't Always Win. Find links to more analysis of economic inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 17th, tens of thousands of Americans and a contingent of Canadians rallied on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to demand that President Obama veto the government permit needed by TransCanada to build the Keystone XL pipeline across the international border that would carry tar sands oil from Alberta to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. The rally, claimed as the largest climate change protest in U.S. history, was organized by the Sierra Club and 350.org. The extraction of tar sands oil in northern Canada, much of it on indigenous lands occupied by what are called First Nations, has already destroyed large areas of the land, poisoning both water and air. That's likely the cause of new and more frequent occurrences of cancer and respiratory ailments among both humans and animals that live there. The spirited 2.5-hour rally in Washington featured a dozen speakers, including Van Jones, who worked briefly in the Obama White House as special advisor on green jobs. He now works with a group, Rebuild the Dream. Here is his short but powerful speech.
President Obama, all the good that you have done, all the good you can imagine doing will be wiped out by floods, by fires, by superstorms, if you fail to act now to deal with this crisis that is a gun pointed at the head of the future. Everything you have done, history will judge you 20 years from now. Based on one decision alone. That decision is not in the hands of the Congress. That decision is not in the hands of any governors. That decision is not in the hands of any mayors or any dog catchers. The decision is in your hands, Mr. President. It's in your hands. Your hands. The decision to let this pipeline come through America is the most fateful decision you will ever make, Mr. President. It would be like jabbing a dirty needle into this country from Canada. It would be like lighting a fuse on a carbon bomb. That's what it would be like doing, Mr. President. And you cannot allow that to happen. If the pipeline goes through, Mr. President, the first thing it runs over will not be farmland. The first thing it runs over will not be small towns. If you let this pipeline go through, Mr. President, the first thing it runs over is the credibility of the President of the United States of America. That's the first thing it runs over. That's the first thing it runs over. I want to say unequivocally to this next generation, stop being chumps. I'm going to say it again. To the next generation, stop being chumps. You elected this president. You re-elected this president. You gave him the chance to make history. He needs to give you the chance to have a future. Stop being chumps. Stop being chumps and fight for your future. Thank you very much.
We next hear an excerpt from a talk given at a forum held on the evening after the rally titled Women of the Land Speak, Dispatches from the Frontlines of the Tar Sands to Renewables, featuring two Native women from Canada and two white ranchers from the U.S. Eleanor Fairchild is a Texas rancher, some of whose property was taken by TransCanada through eminent domain to build the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline, which is already under construction.
I found out at the State Department what tar sands was and the damage it was doing in Canada and how much water it took to get it out, how expensive it was. And that was when I decided, well, I was mad because they lied to me. And I decided that I needed to fight this. But I've never done this before. This is my first experience with this. But at this point, TransCanada is on my land, and the pipe's in the ground. One thing that I can't understand in this whole thing is how TransCanada has so much power in the United States. It's a foreign company. I think that it's immoral for us as a nation to allow a pipeline to come through here with tar sands that's not even going to be for us in the first place, but I don't like tar sands anywhere. But they ought to leave it in the ground. But I think it's immoral for us to enable Canada to do what it's doing. As a people, I think it's wrong. I think about our children, and people talk about our debt. You know, we can get out of a debt. But if we mess up our water and our earth doing something stupid, like using this stuff, tar sands, you know, we might make it an earth where our children can't live. It might be a thing that we can't even solve regardless of how much money we have. I think if we're not careful, we're going to destroy ourselves and everything on this earth. It's time to start thinking about what we do today.
That was Texas rancher Eleanor Fairchild speaking at a forum sponsored by the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus with the Indigenous Environmental Network and 350.org. This report on the February 17th Keystone XL pipeline protest in Washington, D.C. was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. 10 years ago, a growing number of people across the globe were becoming more and more concerned about then-President George W. Bush's escalating public threats to go to war with Saddam Hussein over the alleged danger posed by Iraq's claimed stockpile of weapons of mass destruction. Those grave accusations, coupled with vague charges that Hussein's government was somehow linked with the 9/11 attacks against the U.S. 2 years earlier, laid the groundwork to attract public support for President Bush's decision to launch an invasion of Iraq on March 19, 2003. Scattered demonstrations in the U.S. and around the world to prevent a new war with Iraq before it started reached a crescendo on February 15, 2003, when an estimated 30 million people marched against the planned invasion of Iraq. Protests were organized in over 350 cities across the globe, including rallies in New York, London, Berlin, Paris, Barcelona, Rome, Melbourne, Cape Town, Auckland, Seoul, and Tokyo. Your reporter spoke with two individuals who were directly involved in organizing the February 2003 protest: Bill Fletcher Jr., editorial board member and columnist with the online publication BlackCommentator.com, immediate past president of TransAfrica Forum, and at the time, co-chair of the nation's largest anti-war coalition, United for Peace and Justice, and Leslie Kagan, a lifelong political activist who served as national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, responsible for organizing the New York City rally near the United Nations. Together, they reflect on the significance of the massive global anti-war protests 10 years ago, their failure to stop the war, and the importance of reviving cross-border organizing on urgent issues of peace and social justice today.
What was clear right from the get-go was that this would be a truly global day of action. I don't think any of us knew how big it was going to be until the day happened and all the reports started coming in. But it was clear right from the get-go that this was not just about one country or one anti-war movement in one country. It was about a global outcry and demand that the U.S. not go to war. And that was something that I don't think any of us had ever experienced anything on that scale and to that degree. And that was extremely powerful and gave us some little bit of something to hold on to hope that maybe we could be strong enough to actually prevent this war from happening, even though we knew what we were up against. But there was some glimmer of hope and possibility, and that in and of itself is a powerful force.
Well, I want to get to your reflections as well, Bill, but I'll just run down some of the numbers. You know, it's hard to know the accuracy of these things 10 years later, but, you know, the estimates of 500,000 to 1 million people came to New York City for that big protest close to the United Nations. 500,000 to 750,000 people in Hyde Park in London, 200,000 in Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, and hundreds of thousands more protested in Paris, Amsterdam, Brussels, Barcelona, Rome, Melbourne in Australia, Cape Town, South Africa, Johannesburg, Auckland, New Zealand, Seoul, Tokyo, and Manila. I mean, it was just enormous. As Leslie said, you know, we didn't realize how big it was till we all got home and kind of read the papers, heard the media announcements about what had happened that day. Bill, what are your sort of reflections on the importance of that day?
Well, I guess the first thing is that it was the right thing to do. And even though we did not stop the war, which is a point I want to get to, that level of mobilization was a critical domestic and global statement. And I think you can say in all honesty that it sent ripple effects that we feel to this day, including the eventual election of Obama in 2008. So I think that it was very important. It was very, very exciting. And at the same time, I think that much of the anti-war movement didn't study its history enough, or study history of the United States, or for that matter, other countries, because the ability to stop a war from starting is it's very limited. When a ruling group is sufficiently united, they're prepared to pull the trigger. It's very easy for them to pull a trigger. And if you look back, whether it was the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, the Philippine-American War, World War I, there were significant anti-war movements And what anti-war movements generally can do is to contribute to ending a war in conjunction with other factors. It's very hard to stop. So part of the problem was that we were elated after February 15th at the numbers that had turned out in the United States and elsewhere, but that was not enough to stop Bush and Cheney. And I think that what we have to come to grips with is that probably nothing short of bringing the country to a halt would have stopped the invasion.
I wanted to maybe leave off on some new news that Leslie can bring to us about a major, I think the largest demonstration yet on global warming issues in Washington, D.C. Leslie, we don't have a lot of time here, but maybe you could give us a quick update and how you think this current movement for, you know, responsible climate change policy can, you know, move us to international organizing.
Right, right. Well, talk about an issue that affects everybody. I mean, climate change is a global phenomenon. It was very clear yesterday. I honestly believe there were at least 50,000 people out in Washington, D.C. on a pretty cold day, but a lot of the focus was on the Keystone Pipeline, which, of course, is supposed to run from Canada through, you know, right down the spine of the United States. So there, right away, is, you know, more than one country organizing. And the level of cooperation that we need to have between U.S. organizers and Canadian organizers on this is, you know, it's critical that that happen. We have to understand that we are part of a global community. And I think there is a potential, you know, on the climate change issue to strengthen that cross-border organizing. Climate change is not an isolated phenomenon. It's related to wars for oil, for instance. We have to make those connections if we're going to be strong enough to make any policy difference.
That was Bill Fletcher, Jr., former co-chair of United for Peace and Justice, and Leslie Kagan, the group's co-founder and national coordinator, who were both instrumental in organizing the February 15, 2003 Global Day of Protests against the war in Iraq. Find more reflections on the significance of those demonstrations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.